The Texas Supreme Court rules fear of contracting coronavirus not a disability under election law. The implications for voting by mail in Texas today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. We'll have more on the decision in the vote by mail controversy and why it may not prove to be the final word on the subject. Also, as institutions of higher ed struggle over how to move forward, we talk to the presidents of two historically black colleges in Texas about how best to help the communities they serve, especially hard hit by COVID-19. Plus, Dr. Fred Campbell takes more listener questions about the coronavirus and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 28th day of May, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. If past is prologue, the things we obsess over now can be scarcely remembered years hence. Take the last pandemic of proportions like the current one, almost forgotten to everyday folks by the late 1930s as the world refocused on other things. With much of the news dedicated to COVID-19 at the moment, and rightfully so, give credit where credit is due to the New York Times this morning, which broke from the ongoing top story long enough to turn its main focus to China. The communist government there has ordered a new law to rein in Hong Kong, with most signs pointing to a crackdown against pro-democracy resistors in September. Specifics are thin, but the impact is likely to resonate globally in matters from Taiwan to the international supply chain and the relationship of China with the West, with considerable implications for war and peace. What some may regard as a footnote today promises to reverberate long after the war against the coronavirus is fought and won. But for now, that more immediate battle must go on, and institutions of higher education are among those on the front lines. For starters, what happens in the fall? We've been having conversations with university presidents to talk about that, and today we check in with the presidents of two historically black colleges committed to serving communities of color that have been among those hardest hit by COVID-19. Paul Quinn College in Dallas was founded back in 1872. Houston Tillotson in Austin was established in 1875. Colette Pierce Burnett, Ph.D., is president of Houston Tillotson University. President Pierce Burnett, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Michael Sorrell, Ph.D., from Paul Quinn College. Dr. Sorrell, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with your plans for the fall, because that seems to be the most pressing question for a lot of students and educators. I'll begin with you, President Pierce Burnett. What has been your decision when it comes to reopening Houston Tillotson?
We have not made a final decision. We've been gathering as much information as we can. It's a complicated decision. We want to do it where we're still honoring the students' experience, their academic mm-hmm. as well as their outside of the classroom experience, but we right. want to make a very informed decision. And we plan on making an announcement no later than the end of June.
President Sorrell, what about Paul Quinn College?
This is such an incredibly important decision to make that there's no need to rush. We are living in a time where making the wrong decision here could cost people not only their health and well-being, but maybe even their lives. And when those are the stakes, then you are well served to ensure that you have taken your time, you've been very thorough and intentional, and you act with the best interest of your community in mind. And I think you have to be very, very careful.
Well, now I want to follow up with what some of the other colleges are doing. We spoke recently with the president of Texas Tech, and we've also talked with officials from the University of Texas. And I get a sense that they feel like there's a special weight that's been placed on them to make the right decision as smaller colleges and universities look to some of the larger institutions for direction on this. Is that really happening or not so much? I want to first direct that to President Pierce Burnett.
That's not happening at all for me. My institution can't make a decision under the umbrella or on the heels of another institution that doesn't service the same population, doesn't have the same facilities, doesn't have the same resources, doesn't have the same location, doesn't have the same mission, et cetera. So it's unrealistic for me to look at another institution and try to make a very important decision about the direction of Houston Tillotson.
President Sorrell,
let me just add this, that this mistaken idea that just because you are larger than another institution that somehow your decision-making paradigm carries more weight than anyone else's is just flat out wrong.
I want to follow up on that, because you wrote a thought-provoking editorial for The Atlantic, President Sorrell, talking about how institutions are letting their financial and reputational worries cloud their judgment about when they can safely reopen. How so?
I think it's important that every president make decisions based on their institution's best interest, but also align with their moral compass. And my moral compass tells me that it is absolutely essential that before I take any action, I ask myself, if I am wrong, do I want to bear the consequences of that wrong? And is that wrong something that could lead me down a path to which I cannot recover? For 13 years, I have been president at Paul Quinn College, and I have been proud of the fact that regardless of what has gone on, we've had no deaths. We have worked our best to keep people safe and as unharmed as possible. And I take that seriously. And so the idea that we would jeopardize people's health because of financial concerns is just not one that I would ever be comfortable with. I have asked this question from the beginning, and no one has been able to answer it, and it is simply this. Tell me now what is materially different from when in March, when we sent the students home, that exists today. Do we have a vaccine? Do we have a cure? Do we have widespread testing? All I can tell we have is more cases, a developing understanding of the severity of this disease. People are getting this, and they're not recovering fully. Their bodies are materially changed.
Forgive me for interrupting. I'm concerned about the time that we have for this segment, but I want to go back to something that President Pierce Burnett was saying when she was drawing out the distinctions that she faces as president of an historically black college in Austin, Texas. You were pointing out we have geographic differences. We have resource challenges that are different from the larger institutions. Of course, we have to serve our community and be conscious of that. On the question of resources and community, as you're probably aware, there are a lot of high school seniors, graduates, who are debating right now, reevaluating their plans for college. And if we're waiting for a vaccine, that could be a very long time indeed. Are you concerned about the future of Houston-Tillotson from the standpoint of survival?
No, I'm not. Operating in a crisis is not new to my institution. What's new is the COVID-19, and that compounds something that we've had to be challenged with since our inception. We were founded on the fact of a race of people having defiance and fortitude and power and resilience, and we've been pulling on that same kind of thread and fabric of the institution for 145 years. That's not new. So my institution will be stronger as a result of this. We have to continue to be good stewards of our resources. We have to continue to encourage people to invest in our mission. What's new is that I have a hidden enemy that I'm fighting against. What we're doing with our students is encouraging them to stay engaged because they can't afford to take a gap year. So my job is to help to find resources to help to close that gap. And now it's more of a heightened sense of urgency than I had 2 months ago. What I do worry about is the families that continue to not be able to afford that education, more middle-income people. So what I do is I channel that energy to try to encourage philanthropic agencies, particularly here in Austin, to support institutions like Houston-Tillotson through this kind of crisis.
But if the standard for reopening is, can I ensure the safety of these students? What I'm wondering is, how do you do that? I mean, barring finding a vaccine or some kind of therapeutic silver bullet, which doesn't seem to be on the horizon, President Sorrell, how are you going to ensure safety at Paul Quinn?
Well, the first thing is we have to stop using the language of reopening.
Right.
The school's never closed.
We're not closing.
right? Like, they've always been open. We delivered
the
learning.
We're still open right now.
Right. I mean, like, my student, I have 300 plus students in summer school, right? We finished the semester with a full student body. We never closed. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, there is nothing that has been written that says that you are better served rushing into anything. I am perfectly comfortable taking the time necessary to make sure that I have given my students and my faculty and my staff and my community the best chance to be safe and to be whole. And if that means that we take a semester online, okay. If that means we take a year online, I'm okay with that too. My previous career was in crisis management. Mm-hmm. So I'm well steeped in how you manage scenarios where everyone else sees no way out. There's always a way out, just as panic always makes it worse.
Michael Sorrell is president of Paul Quinn College, and Colette Pierce Burnett is president of Houston Tillotson University. Thank you both for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you.
No, thank you for the invitation.
Safety first, that's the message for sure. Joining us now is Wells Dunbar. He's our social media editor. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Good to hear from you today. We're hearing
Likewise.
From folks about the effects of the pandemic on historically black colleges, universities, and institutions of higher learning in general. Here are some of the responses we're hearing on Facebook. Christian Monsalves sees these issues as part of a larger paradigm. He writes that COVID-19 has put a big magnifying glass on social inequality, and I see it as the result of many decades of political and financial class differences. Another comment via Facebook, Linda Pallett ponders what will happen to the educational system, naming it as potentially one of several that are due for a big disruption. She says she's thinking about the institutions that will not survive this current crisis without major evolution, such as the health system, the retail system, and more. And obviously, I don't need to tell you or our listeners out there that all of those systems have seen big shakeups due to the pandemic. Just some of the responses we're seeing out there, David. I'll be back with more from social media later in the broadcast.
We would love to hear your thoughts on how higher ed in particular might be changing as a result of COVID-19. We know that there will be changes. We just don't know how profound, but they are certain to be. You can reach out to us at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, dedicated to providing clear and scientifically vetted information about COVID-19. Texas A&M articles and reports about this global pandemic are available at fearlessfront.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The U.S. Justice Department says the death of George Floyd has been made a top priority, and prosecutors have been assigned to investigate his death in police custody. Last night, stores in Minneapolis were set alight and police fired tear gas at protesters as outrage grew over a video showing an officer pressing his knee into Floyd's neck despite him begging for his life. Floyd was from Houston's 3rd Ward, a standout high school athlete and part of the local rap community. Houston Public Media's Matt Harab reports.
Friends and family describe George Floyd as a gentle giant. He grew up in Houston's 3rd Ward, where he was a star multi-sport athlete at Jack Yates High School, talented enough to get a basketball scholarship from Florida State University. He didn't finish college, but pursued his other passion, making music back in Houston under the name Big Floyd. He collaborated with the late Texas hip-hop artist DJ Screw in this song, Sitting on Top of the World. A few years ago, Floyd moved to Minneapolis to start a new life. The Houston Chronicle reports he found work as a truck driver and a bouncer.
He had just called me.
His childhood friend, Milton Carney, spoke to Fox 26 at a vigil in Emancipation Park.
You just got your first piece of property, man. That means, yeah, it's working. You won't be all right.
Now, his friends and family and many others are outraged over his death. Minneapolis police say Floyd looked like a suspect in an ongoing investigation and that he resisted arrest. But his family's attorney, Benjamin Crump, says surveillance footage from a nearby restaurant where he was placed in custody shows he never resisted arrest. Crump spoke with CBS this morning.
You can see his demeanor from the security video. They did not have to use this excessive lethal force.
On video, Floyd is heard telling police he can't breathe as a white officer plants his leg into Floyd's neck, which killed him. The four officers involved have been fired. Houston City Council member Jerry Davis is still frustrated.
What in the hell makes you think it's appropriate to put your damn knee on someone's neck? Are you that fearful of us as black males? I just don't get it.
Houston has its own issues with excessive force by police right now. In the last 5 weeks, six people have been shot and killed by Houston police officers. Activists are calling for body camera video to be released of all the incidents. Here's civil rights attorney Randy Callinan on Houston Matters.
We were promised that we would have openness when Chief Acevedo came, and we are not getting any openness.
The latest shooting happened Monday when police found a man waving a gun outside his home. Chief Art Acevedo has asked Houstonians to consider the six cases separately and says his officers responded to the actions of individuals. He says his department will release body camera footage after they finish the investigations and the families of the victims have reviewed it first. I'm Matt Harab in Houston.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, it stands to reason that with lots of people staying home more than ever, virtual reality headsets like Facebook's Oculus and Samsung's Gear are quite popular right now. Some devices are even backordered. But there's something else going on here, too. Companies are investing new money into VR, a segment of the entertainment world that so far found it hard to grow beyond a niche following among gamers. Tech expert Omar Gayaga is joining us now to talk about why VR is hot and how long it's likely to stay that way. Hello, Omar.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
I guess if you don't like the reality that's out there, you could always take it virtual to some extent, at least. Although I have to say that it's been a long time since I experienced VR, and it was a little buggy. What's it like now?
Yeah, that's the thing. VR is one of those technologies that kind of keeps coming and going. We keep seeing these flashes of, oh, it's going to be the next big thing. And oh, wait, no, it's not. People are disappointed with it. And it's still kind of the big kind of bulky headsets that you have to put on and kind of isolate yourself from the world. What has happened this year, though, I mean, as you said, people are stuck at home. They're looking for new ways to escape, to do different things. And VR kind of provides that. But what's also happening is all this new investment in, and there's actually several new headsets, too, that have debuted. Valve, the big gaming company, came out with one called the Index. And the former co-founder of HTC has a whole new headset that we hadn't even heard about until now. And that's got a big investment in it. So all these technologies that seemed like they were starting to become passe, that people were starting to kind of write off, are now surging again. It's a very weird time for VR.
Is there anything new about the headsets that make them especially innovative? Or are they still these sort of bulky eyepieces that you have to strap on front and back?
There's still this goal of kind of getting to a place where these are more like glasses than headsets. Apple made an investment in a company and is rumored to be kind of coming out with something closer to Google Glass in the next couple of years. Magic Leap is a company that keeps getting investments, even though they have no real viable product yet that anybody has bought. Their goal is kind of to make it more augmented kind of glasses reality than big headsets. But one of the big reasons that VR has had a kind of surge this season is that one big high profile video game came out in March that everybody was waiting for in the gaming world. And that has kind of gotten people to try these devices or to kind of bring them back out of the closet to try them to play this.
Now, you mentioned the video games. I guess I've always assumed that the audience for VR is primarily gamers. Is that still the case?
It is. I mean, you're seeing some of it in the medical field. You're seeing some of it in science and research and in kind of entertainment. If you go to like, you can't do it right now, but if you go to a theme park, you know, 6 months ago, you were seeing a lot of this at like Orlando in Universal Studios and Disney. But this video game, Half-Life Alyx, that came out in March, really created a kind of renewed interest in it. It's from the company Valve that, that made all of the Half-Life games. And people have been waiting for a game like this for, you know, years. And it got really good reviews. So, it is one of the few and far between kind of hit anticipated titles in VR. There really aren't that many. Companies are not really investing in these big AAA games.
So you got to have that really popular software to kind of keep the excitement going, which raises the question, do you think VR will ever really go mainstream, that which is to say beyond gaming, as some of its early advocates predicted it would? I mean, what kind of things could we be doing with virtual reality in the next few years, realistically speaking?
I think everyone's bets are kind of on augmented reality and kind of this mix between VR that we're seeing now with the bulky headsets and something that more goes over your, you know, your vision, kind of like glasses or something much more lightweight, and that could kind of layer different types of information over what you're seeing in front of you. But the question is like, how soon, and are these companies going to run out of money before they can get us there? And how mainstream is it going to be? Right now, it feels like it's people buying these $500 headsets that can afford to do that and kind of deal with the technological hurdles of setting it all up. So it's just, VR is one of those technologies that, you know, how soon, you know, are they gonna make it? Is it gonna go the way of 3D television or not? We're still waiting to see, but right now it feels like it is resurging.
Omar Gayaga keeps an eye on the real and virtual worlds over at TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, thanks again. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, David. I appreciate it.
You know, it's interesting. I was just reading a story from CBS TV station in Los Angeles talking about how virtual reality might give sports fans a chance to return to the arenas virtually. In fact, in the U.S., the Minnesota Vikings have created their own app, Vikings VR, within the Oculus store. In fact, that was sometime before COVID-19. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Would you attend a sports event using virtual reality? Tweet us at Texas Standard. Coming up on 29 Minutes Past the Hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where horned frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Governor Greg Abbott predicts the Texas Panhandle will see another spike in COVID-19 cases in the days ahead, linked to the meatpacking industry. That's because employees at the JBS beef plant north of Amarillo were recently tested for the virus.
So that is to be expected. We will not be surprised. In fact, I would be surprised if we did not see that spike.
Amarillo has been confronting its own coronavirus outbreak related to a Tyson meatpacking plant. During a visit there Wednesday, Governor Abbott explained Amarillo had turned a corner in its effort to contain COVID-19. The U.S. Labor Department reports more than 128,000 Texans filed for unemployment last week. While the number of claims has been declining for weeks now, Texas Workforce Commission spokesperson Cisco Gomez said Wednesday the agency has helped nearly 2.8 million Texans apply for benefits since mid-March.
The Texas Workforce Commission has also paid out over $8.2 billion in benefits using state and federal funds.
Gomez says the state's largest single-day payout for benefits was Tuesday, totaling $800 million. Big Bend National Park reopens June 1st. As Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales reports, it's been closed for nearly 8 weeks due to concerns about COVID-19.
The sprawling national park, which covers 800,000 acres of desert land, will open slowly and in phases. Park Superintendent Bob Krummenacker has been drafting a reopening plan for weeks now. He's talked with staff and received feedback from local, state, and federal public health authorities. He says they've all advised him to, quote, go slow and make sure it's working. During the first stage of reopening, the park will only be open for daytime use, and visitors will only have access to a handful of trails.
People get a park experience, it just won't be the complete park experience yet.
If there are no spikes in cases or any problems at the park, the next stage of reopening will be on June 15th. I'm Carlos Morales in Marfa.
Agriculture experts are working to contain a recent spread of cattle fever ticks in South Texas. They've been found as far north as Corpus Christi. Entomologist Sonia Swiger with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service explains that's outside the permanent quarantine zone along the U.S.-Mexico border that's helped contain the ticks for decades.
We don't want this to go above South Texas because, of course, as it moves further, that's more cattle that are impacted, more cattle to check, and then eventually it could become a statewide issue more so than just the South Texas issue.
The ticks can carry devastating livestock diseases. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's that time once again for your questions about COVID-19. We've been asking listeners to send whatever question they have about the pandemic to us, and we'll get them forwarded to Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Great to be healthy and here again.
Amen. Let's begin with this question from listener Laura Rauscher. She says, both of my children play youth sports, hockey and basketball, which are set to resume their season on June 15th and July 1st, respectively. We live in McKinney and are concerned about the gradual rise in cases we've seen in Collin and Dallas counties since the governor relaxed restrictions weeks ago. And she asks, how safe are such activities given the close proximity of the players, indoor venues, and the lack of a decline in cases in the area? What do you tell her?
Unfortunately, David, I have to tell her that there is absolutely no guarantee that young people are not going to acquire COVID-19. And although most cases are either asymptomatic or mild, there have been some life-threatening cases of COVID-19 in otherwise real healthy young people. You know, the problem, unfortunately, is that role models that they have sometimes are not very good at adhering to distancing kinds of recommendations or masks. So I think that it's unlikely that it's going to be applicable to young people.
Staying on this subject of kids and summer activities, Dr. Campbell, what should parents consider before sending their kids to either day camps or sleepaway summer camps now that they're reopened?
I had this kind of conversation with my own daughters who are sending my grandchildren, or at least considering sending my grandchildren out to do those kinds of activities. I think many camps are trying to do as much as they possibly can, perhaps to have small quarantine groups within the camps that will spend a lot of time or virtually all their time together, which minimizes exposure. And I know that they're doing everything they can to try to adhere to those ideas like masking and distancing. I wish it was that simple and that effective. And again, I think that right now it is still premature to do an awful lot of close quarters, particularly in regard to our young people, because they will be coming home and exposing much higher risk individuals after they come back from their camp or sporting experiences.
Now, this next question was emailed to us by listener Luann Miller, and Luann asks, I've had close contact with a person who has flown in from out of town. It was a guest in their home. And that person, they believe, might be carrying the virus. Would she need to avoid being in public for 2 weeks in case she was infected?
Well, that's an excellent question. Flying has been posing a significant amount of risk as far as transmission of COVID-19, despite all the efforts of the airline industry. So that person probably would be at higher risk of eventually developing symptoms. Now, again, since at least a quarter of patients will have the COVID-19 virus infection without symptoms, it's impossible to know for sure. But a 10 to 14 day quarantine period seems reasonable, actually after about 10 days, the likelihood of picking up anything from that sort of individual would be extremely low.
Finally, there's a bit of a catch-all question that's been sent to us by an anonymous listener who asks, with a lot of people going outside and getting back to what's, well, what used to be normal, how safe is it to be around people in public, would you say?
Everything is relative when it comes to this particular condition. The idea of being outside, for instance, is far less dangerous than being inside at the same distances. The idea of wearing a mask is extremely important in close quarters inside. There are situations where when someone is exercising or in a significant outdoor distance from someone else, masking would be probably less of a necessity. So there are a lot of things that apply to being inside, I think, that would be a whole lot stricter than outside, but still, social distancing is very important.
We've been speaking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. We'll have him on regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. And if you have something you'd like us to ask, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks again for joining us. We certainly do appreciate your advice and your wisdom.
My pleasure. Stay safe, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
My name is Ariela Perez. I'm a senior at Rio Grande City High School. I'm supposed to graduate on Friday. So our school is doing this thing called a drive-through graduation. And so they assigned us all a different time to go. And they set up like a stage at school. And our parents are supposed to drive us to school. And our principal is presenting us with our diploma. And then we have to get back in the car to leave. It's a lot better than I expected. I've seen some other schools that aren't doing anything for their kids. So I'm grateful that they're at least doing something for us, but it would have been nice to have an actual ceremony. But I guess that works. So on the week before we got out for spring break, my teachers started assigning us like huge packets. And we were thinking like, they're crazy. Like we're gonna come back in 2 weeks. And then about 2 days before we were supposed to get back to school, our principal sent out a message that we weren't going to be returning until April. So that's when all of us were like, oh my gosh, all of our teachers were right. And then after about a week of staying home, I realized, oh my gosh, like what if we don't get to go back? Like we just ended off the year without even knowing it. Everyone started announcing that prom was canceled and all of our events were canceled. We didn't even get to enjoy anything. Well, I'm in the top 10%, and they always have a huge banquet for us. So I was really sad that we didn't get to have it because it's supposed to be one of the more fancy banquets, I guess you could say. And then there's also prom. I wanted to go with my friends, but we didn't get to. I guess there's been good things as well. Me and my friends have gotten closer in the sense of talking on the phone. I mean, we would never really do that since we would see each other every day. And I guess we're just finding ways to still keep in touch. It was kind of hard not getting to say goodbye to them, especially considering we may never see some of them again. but I guess it has helped us learn how to communicate better. I plan to attend the University of Texas at Austin next year to major in neuroscience. They canceled our orientation, they moved it online. And when I heard about that, I was so sad because everyone tells us that orientation is where you meet all your friends, it's where you get to know the school. So I was pretty bummed about that. Well, I just think that this disease has really showed us a lot of things that we hadn't realized before. I never realized how big of a thing graduation would be until they told us we weren't going to be able to have it. But I'm glad that we are having some sort of graduation. My name is Ariela Perez. I'm a senior graduating from Rio Grande City High School. And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Visual artist Mark Bradford made his early works out of the strips of paper he'd collect from the floor of his mother's hair salon in Los Angeles. Those end papers launched his career, and he's since mounted shows from New York to Shanghai and currently Fort Worth. Bradford's exhibition at the Modern Art Museum was interrupted by the pandemic, but KERA's Miguel Perez explains how the museum has taken the conversation to the streets.
If you've driven down Jacksboro Highway or the Lancaster Corridor in Fort Worth recently, you might have seen a photo of a dashing man dressed head to toe in bright yellow. Mr. Lamar was an influential hairdresser to the upper crust of St. Louis.
The sepia tone with the yellow suit and the yellow dresses and the yellow jumpsuits that the women are wearing and the yellow signage on the side of his car.
Tiffany Wolf Smith, an assistant curator of education at the Modern, helped get the photos up on billboards as part of a program called Modern Billings.
Most of these billboards are in lower income areas, and the artists get all the credit too. We don't put our logo anywhere, so it's just kind of artwork that is just popping up and existing in these communities.
The Modern worked with artist Mark Bradford, whose work is currently hanging in the museum. Now, Bradford didn't take the photos. He chose them from the personal archive of a friend, but the images do speak to his own story.
I like to make work with my life, but not about my life.
Bradford's early paintings look like snakeskin or complex maps, but they're actually made from the strips of paper used to wrap curls into perms. He discovered the material working in his mother's hair salon. The end papers also offer a subtle hint at Bradford's path to becoming an artist.
I was certainly a formed person before I went to art school. I was 30 years old. And I was one of those people that fell through the cracks, and by the time I was in fifth grade, I was creative, but there was absolutely no architecture or structure around that creative black child.
Bradford has since expanded beyond end papers, but he still looks to the debris of daily urban life. His works look like worn-down billboards created by sanding and tearing away mounds of paper and paint.
I'm my own archaeological dig. I dig on my own surfaces, and I cover them up, and I dig. Really, it's about how much I'm willing to reveal and how much I want to cover up.
Bradford uses everything from handbills to magazine clippings. Messages about racial and socioeconomic disparities are hidden deep within layers of colorful paper, sourced from advertisements Bradford collects around his studio in South Central LA.
I don't take everything. On a telephone pole, there's advertisements for all different types of things. I only take businesses that have a direct relationship with that local community that generally they're probably exploiting.
Bradford doesn't just advocate for underserved communities in his paintings. He also helped establish Art and Practice, a nonprofit that provides access to creative resources and contemporary art to communities in South LA.
We have to stop asking people to always get on buses, trains, and come to us up on the hill and then feel comfortable. Well, what if we took these conversations, what if we took these shows, and we just had them in local communities? Then that makes it that these contemporary ideas don't just belong to middle-upper class white art world.
The Modern's Billboard Initiative is a small but worthwhile step in that direction. Assistant curator Jesse Barnett says the museum hopes to extend its reach through public works, like the photos of Mr. Lamar that Bradford selected.
Most of the other kind of visual landscapes are total commercial advertisements. So to have something which is completely just image-based and without any kind of branding, it's a kind of a nice interruption.
An interruption that hopefully sparks conversation outside the walls of the Modern until its doors reopen. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
If you're concerned about catching the coronavirus at the polls, can you cast a mail-in ballot in Texas? New news on that front coming up as the Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, dedicated to making a college education available to all who seek it. Details about how Texas A&M fulfills its land-grant mission at keeplearning.tamu.edu.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The legal battle over mail-in voting took a major turn on Wednesday with a ruling by the Texas Supreme Court. The court sided with State Attorney General Ken Paxton, who claimed that a lack of immunity to the new coronavirus would not qualify voters to claim a disability and vote by mail. But is it the final word on the matter? For the latest, we're joined by Taylor Goldenstein. She is Austin Bureau reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Taylor, welcome back to the Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So this ruling yesterday, lack of immunity to coronavirus alone is not a disability under Texas election code. But there seems to be more than that. In fact, it seems like there's a bit of a gray area that the court left here. Can you explain?
Right. So the court pretty much put the onus on the voter and said that they can take into consideration aspects of their health and their health history that they consider physical conditions.
What does that mean as a practical matter? If you're a voter and you want to take advantage of that gray area, what do you do?
Well, let's say you have, you know, diabetes or a heart condition, and that in combination with the fear of contracting COVID-19 to you would constitute a physical condition. It sounds like the court is saying you can go ahead and do that.
Now, how is it that Texas elections officials are supposed to respond? In other words, what about the county court clerks who are responsible for managing these elections?
Right. Well, it was brought up in court that there is no, you know, explanation for when someone checks the box for disability. So the court said that clerks don't have the responsibility to go any further than the application and investigate any kind of a disability claim.
Now, just to be clear, this is not the only way that you can get a mail-in ballot. Texas voters can qualify for mail-in ballots in other ways too, right?
Correct. If you're over 65, you don't need an excuse. And if you're under, there are a few different categories, being disabled, of course, but then also being out of the county during the election or being in jail, those kinds of things.
Some people might fear that they would be committing some form of perjury if they checked off on an official form that they had a disability. And I was looking at Texas election code here, which defines disability as a sickness or physical condition that prevents a voter from appearing in person without the risk of injuring the voter's health. Now, can someone in good conscience then claim a disability? Is that your understanding, at least as far as the Texas Supreme Court is concerned?
It sounds like they're saying as long as it's not only that lack of immunity that someone is claiming, that would be up to them.
So how is this being received? Because I know that this has been hotly charged in political circles.
Definitely, not just in Texas, but across the country. Definitely the response you would expect is happening here. Democratic Party is very disappointed and already kind of throwing political argument against the justices that made the ruling. And then, of course, the Republican Party has been celebrating it and, feeling validated in some of their claims about this, you know, more mail-in voting leading to voter fraud.
Why is it that Republicans have been fighting this so hard?
I think one of the big issues for a lot of voters has been the voter fraud issue. Even President Donald Trump has brought this up a lot over Twitter. But the studies that we've seen so far haven't indicated that voter fraud is quite as prevalent as that.
Just to be clear, this is not necessarily the final word on this story either, because as you mentioned, there are fights going on across the country, President Trump has weighed in on this matter, and the federal courts are dealing with a similar case, a related case too, right?
Correct. Yeah, the federal courts still have to decide on a similar case filed by the Texas Democratic Party, and we should be seeing a decision any moment on, you know, whether they will stay a federal judge's order that allowed the expansion of mail-in voting. And then, of course, you know, everyone expects this case to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, so we've got time.
So stay tuned, in other words, and you can bet that Taylor Goldenstein continues to cover this story as a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to her latest over at texasstandard.org. Taylor, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is monitoring the Talk of Texas on this Thursday. Wells, what are you hearing?
Hey, David. Well, returning to the interview we just heard, plenty of thoughts as to this latest ruling from the Texas Supreme Court regarding voting by mail. If y'all have been paying attention to this ongoing legal back and forth, you wouldn't be surprised that our friends out there on social media do have a lot of strong opinions about this one. Here's some of the reactions we're seeing out there. Christopher Bart says, I'm thinking there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be out of town on election day. He says that's a valid reason to get your absentee ballot by mail. Goes to some of those issues you were just speaking about there, David, about the fact that people can still apply. In that ruling from the Supreme Court, basically not saying that there is reason to investigate such a request for the ballot. So obviously a nuanced issue that continues to upset a lot of people and spark a lot of conversation.
When you say out of town, that's in quotation marks, I presume.
Yeah, one could say that, yes. Similarly, this remark from Herman Torres on our Facebook page. Lots of people sort of echoing this comment. He notes that the decision was reached by a remote meeting over the internet. So lots of folks pointing out the sort of irony here. Robin Bustos notes that the Texas Supreme Court voted remotely to block us from voting remotely. So she asks if they're going back into the office tomorrow there. I think somewhat of a facetious question, but again, speaking to what a lot of people see as the sort of irony here in this ruling from the state's high court on the issue. And as we heard, obviously, one that's probably going to be appealed to the highest court in the land going forward.
That's right.
Another issue that has people talking about, another story we heard earlier in the show, George Floyd, the killing of the man in Minneapolis, Houston native, sparked lots of protests and some riots yesterday. Manuel Leslie calls for a complete rethinking of policing in America. And Manuel writes, if we wanted to, we could design and create empathetic solutions instead of violent hierarchical systems that feed the cycle of suffering and protect and serve only a few. And Jen Wireman, she echoes those remarks, adding that we need full police reform from the top down. Some very remarkable scenes on social media unfolding there in Minneapolis and in protests, some nonviolent protests in cities across the country as well. So again, obviously, sort of the outcry of anger that we saw in these instances yesterday.
You know, the four police officers there in Minneapolis have been fired, as I understand it, and the Minneapolis mayor is saying that the officer seen in the video front and center should be arrested. It's a developing story even as we speak.
Yeah, definitely. And even one with, potential political ramifications at the national level. I've seen some interesting reporting out there on social media about how Amy Klobuchar, as in her role as a prosecutor, elected not to prosecute or bring charges against any of these Minneapolis police officers accused of violence on the job, including the officer who was seen in the video there during a prior complaint. The officer that put his knee on George Floyd's neck and led to his death. So again, obviously a story that folks are talking a lot about on social media, David.
You can bet. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but of course the news continues over at texasstandard.org 24/7, 7 days a week. We'll be back here on the radio tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.